This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 1st of August, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Environmental groups are cautious about a bipartisan plan for a new era of energy reform. We'll hear from LA, where hate crimes have risen nearly 30%. And the fight over language and culture in Nepal takes center row after the new vice president takes his oath of office in Hindi. All that and more after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico has grown this year to occupy 8,000 square miles near the coasts of Texas and Louisiana, making it the second largest on record. The dead zone is an annual concentration of polluted ocean water with too little oxygen to support most forms of marine life. The leading cause is fertilizer runoff from agro-industrial operations along the Mississippi River, which empties into the Gulf. Scientists credit Hurricane Dolly with churning the Gulf waters enough to keep this year's dead zone from setting a new record. In other environmental news, representatives from Germany, France, the UK, Austria, and the Netherlands are meeting to try to weaken a European Commission proposal that would require EU member states to identify and clean up sites polluted by industrial waste. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
The European Commission's proposal requires member states to identify which sites are contaminated, to maintain a public list of these sites, and to say when they would be cleaned up. The bill also requires the identification of farmland at risk of degradation from erosion, landslides, and soil salinity. However, if Germany, France, the UK, Austria, and the Netherlands have their way, contaminated soil in public sites like schools, playgrounds, and hospitals could remain polluted. France, which currently holds the rotating EU presidency, is holding unofficial talks to which only the five opposing countries have been invited, drawing criticism from environmental groups. France wants contaminated sites to be identified only when that site is sold and is also calling for the list of sites not to be made public. Germany doesn't want member states to be obliged to identify areas at risk of soil degradation or be required to rectify the situation. The European Environmental Bureau, a European-wide alliance of local green groups, has accused Germany, the Netherlands and Austria of bowing to pressure from farm lobby groups. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
The controversial Desert Rock power plant on the Navajo Nation in northern New Mexico is one step closer to construction after the Environmental Protection Agency announced the approval of an air permit for the coal-fired power plant. But as Leslie Clark reports, New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson has joined other state officials in disputing the permit.
In issuing the permit, the EPA contends that Desert Rock Power Plant would be one of the cleanest coal-fired power plants in the nation. But New Mexico Governor Richardson, the state attorney general, and the head of the state environment department call the permit ill-advised. The officials suggest the EPA and the power plant construction company, Scythe Global of Houston, cut a deal to evade judicial review of the challenges to the plant. They also allege the EPA violated the Clean Air Act in issuing the permit. But Navajo Nation President Joe Shirley says the estimated $50 million in annual revenues to the tribe and the creation of thousands of jobs outweigh the environmental concerns. Many local residents and environmentalists say emissions from the power plant would threaten the health of people living in the Four Corners area, where two other coal-fired power plants are already operating. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Nearly 65,000 workers at Verizon in the Northeast are set to go on strike Saturday as contract negotiations have stalled, with the company demanding cutbacks to health benefits and the right to outsource despite its profits. Ari Paul has more in New York.
Verizon wants its workers to contribute more to health care costs and says it needs the flexibility to contract labor overseas. When the current contract expires Saturday at midnight, 65,000 workers at the telecom giant in five states are set to lay down their tools to protect their benefits. Salvatore Incarbone is the vice president of Communications Workers of America, Local 1109, and believes the company can afford to go without labor givebacks.
The company made $5.5 billion in profits. Now they want to cut our health care for our active and retired members. Meanwhile, these executives at the top, they receive free health care as well. They're contracting our jobs out to overseas, which is another problem. And you know, we want our jobs here to stay here in America.
In Carbone speculated that Verizon could still operate during a work stoppage, albeit with slower service. The last strike at Verizon lasted 15 days in 2000. In New York, this is Ari Paul for FSRN.
The Department of Homeland Security has been forced to compromise its plans to build an 18-foot-high fence through the campus of the University of Texas at Brownsville and Texas Southmost College. Under the terms of a legal settlement approved yesterday, the university will renovate an existing fence and allow DHS to install cameras and sensors. Meanwhile, District Judge Andrew Hanen set March 2009 trial dates for the DHS condemnation lawsuits against Rio Grande Valley property owners who have refused to give contractors access to their land to build the controversial fence. DHS has been operating under a timeline that called for the barrier to be in place by the end of the year. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
As the Senate leaves on a five-week recess, a bipartisan group of 10 senators came forward Friday morning with a proposal to both decrease foreign dependence on oil and create new incentives for renewable energy. Evenly divided between parties, the group included many rural states, including the Dakotas, as well as Georgia, Arkansas, and South Carolina. But environmental groups are hesitant to jump to offshore drilling as part of a plan for a new era of energy reform. Catherine Jarmul has more.
The bipartisan gang of 10 stood before reporters in D.C., announcing a plan that took about 6 weeks to craft. The proposal aims to relieve America's energy crisis through compromises on both sides of the aisle and was led by Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota and Republican Senator Saxby Chambliss of Georgia. Senator John Thune of South Dakota outlines the main goal of the proposal.
There were a lot of discussions in our group and trying to come to an agreement around those things that we thought we could get the necessary votes to actually pass something. I mean, the whole goal of this is to put something into law.
Called the Comprehensive New Energy Reform Act, or New ERA, the plan has three major provisions. The proposal aims to provide incentives for Americans to make and buy non-petroleum-based vehicles. It also aims to increase domestic production of oil and biofuel and enhance conservation through tax incentives. The proposal increases nuclear energy development and domestic oil speculation on already leased properties. The proposal opens parts of Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico, particularly off the west coast of Florida, for offshore drilling. Senator Chambliss explains why those areas were chosen, given there are no senators from either of those states in the group.
We got to start somewhere. We felt like it was necessary to go to areas that have been identified. So we want to start with a reasonable number of states with the idea that folks across America are going to have some input into this.
But environmental groups criticize the push to drill as a way to fix the energy crisis. Dan Cronin, spokesperson for the Environmental Defense Fund, says this proposal might be a good starting point, but it has a long way to go. Cronin said cap and trade has received bipartisan interest and support, and that this is where Congress should move for the energy bill. Jim Presswood, energy advocate for National Resource Defense Council, says there is no real safe way to drill.
There is always going to be environmental damage. All you have to do is just go down to the Gulf Coast, Louisiana, Texas, and just see the debris and other things like tar balls that wash up on the shore. And also if you have spills like what we saw in the Mississippi River not about just a couple weeks ago, that can have devastating impacts. And so the technology, it has improved, but accidents continue to happen, and we also have ongoing operational pollution from these facilities.
Presswood also says this does not provide a real solution to oil dependence.
Well, the real solution to breaking our dependence on oil is not to get a bigger needle and continue to use more oil. I mean, we have to find alternatives.
Cronin warns oil production as a solution carries additional costs that can't be tabulated in dollars.
It's that cost you can't see. It's that old broken window thing you can't see. It's the cost of the extreme weather caused by climate change that we need to get serious about dealing with.
Congress has been actively pursuing a compromise energy bill for a month and has been stalled by provisions surrounding offshore drilling. Republicans have refused to accept bills that do not include drilling, while Democratic leadership has refused to place drilling on the floor without first looking at speculation on already leased property. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said outer continental shelf drilling is a political ploy.
I will not be a participant in that scheme. We're saying drill offshore. Drill where it is safe, where you have permits, where you can move quickly. But don't try to insult the intelligence of the American people by saying, but for drilling in those protected areas, gasoline would be cheaper. It's simply not true. So when we're talking seriously about a comprehensive energy policy to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, to invest in renewables, we'll talk about that.
Without leadership support, it's unlikely this proposal will move the debate further in regards to a new energy bill. And many say offshore drilling will not provide immediate relief to increasing prices at the pump. With both houses slated to return on September 8th, American consumers can expect little change while their representatives are on vacation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
Although Congress failed to agree on energy proposals as they left town for 5 weeks, they're sending some bills to the president's desk for signature. One bill will double the amount of money given to Pell Grant recipients from $4,000 to $8,000 by 2014. It will also simplify college loan applications from more than 100 questions to a simplified, easy-to-read, two-page questionnaire. The other piece of legislation will increase money, oversight, and regulatory authority to the federal agency in charge of testing and recalling toys and consumer products, Democratic Senator Richard Durbin of Illinois.
As the chairman of the subcommittee that appropriates money for the Consumer Product Safety Commission, trust me, they're going to have plenty of funds to hire plenty of staff to make sure that plenty of families across America will have a holiday season where they have peace of mind. That when they go to the store, what they pick off the shelf is going to be something safe for their kids to play with.
The oversight agency came under fire last year when children's toys exported from China caused illness and death. Investigations found the agency was understaffed and under-resourced after consecutive budget cuts sought to ease regulation. The measure also makes toxic chemicals illegal and imposes new standards for products sold to the U.S., despite intense lobbying from toy companies and manufacturers, the bill passed both bodies overwhelmingly. The president agreed to sign the bill into law. U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents can confiscate anyone's laptop computer or other electronic devices, search them out of the owner's sight, and share the device's contents with other federal agencies and even with private groups who would assist with language translation and data decryption. That's according to the Department of Homeland Security, which released a copy of these policies, which the agency says has already been in place for some time. The searches of electronic devices, including hard drives, cell phones, iPods, and audio tapes, can apply to anyone entering the country, including U.S. citizens. Additionally, agents can search books, pamphlets, and other written material. DHS says it's an effort to prevent terrorism. Senator Russ Feingold called the policy alarming, and digital privacy and civil liberties groups are also raising concerns. Plus, there's opposition from business groups. Ken Meyer is the CEO of Washington Technology Industry Association, which represents some 1,000 businesses in Washington state. Meyer says the policy could have a chilling effect on companies that conduct business abroad.
I think there's a concern that the kinds of information that businesses would normally want to take along on a business trip in order to conduct their business will be truncated to such a degree that it could potentially affect, you know, negotiations, business opportunities. I think that's one aspect of this issue, which is, and it's really unknown at this point, but what will this mean for the course of business when companies who are concerned about the risk of the seizure of materials will go very conservative in what they're going to allow employees to take offshore.
One of Meyer's concerns is that the criterion by which the DHS will inspect a laptop for content and what is subsequently done with the information is unknown, and says there needs to be a balance between security and privacy.
It's not so much that we formally oppose the policy. I think that it's a responsibility of an organization like ours, for whose members do a lot of international travel and for whom the laptop is, you know, the modern equivalent of a briefcase, to be raising questions about what this might mean for those businesses. I think that there just needs to be some thoughtful balance between legitimate security concerns of the government and protection of privacy and business information.
The Washington Technology Industry Association has contacted its congressional delegation, and Meyer spoke with a state senator's aide about the search and seizure of electronic devices. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Hate crimes in L.A. County rose by 28% last year, according to the local Human Relations Commission. And it's not just the number of crimes going up, but the incidents themselves are becoming more violent. Dan Fritz has more on what some are saying is a national trend towards rising hate crimes.
The increase in hate crime of 28% for the county has to concern and alarm all of us.
L.A. County Human Relations Commission Executive Director Robin Long.
This is occurring at a time when crime in general is declining, and we're seeing that it is happening across all groups, all major targeted groups.
The new report finds the largest rise came from Latino suspects against African American victims, followed by African American suspects against Latino victims. Amanda Susskind is the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League. Susskind was one of the advisors to the committee.
The most disproportionately represented group is the African Americans. Once again, the vast majority of hate crimes are against African Americans. 58% of all the hate crimes are against African Americans, and they comprise 9% of the county.
Although incidents went up against all major targeted groups, including Jews, Asians, whites, and Mexicans, the most violent crimes were reserved for transgender victims. 100% of the incidents against transgendered people were violent, followed by 76% of those based on sexual orientation, 71% of racial, and 25% of religious crimes. Susskind says the internet has facilitated an evolution in hate groups and gangs that engage in hate crimes. By providing anonymity and seclusion, people are being seduced to join hate groups and engage in hate crime from the comfort of their home.
Today, what we're seeing is race-based gangs that are in sharing territory, but are defining themselves by hatred of the other race. And that's a fairly new phenomenon. And so in terms of, you know, where it used to be maybe a child or a bystander would be a rare victim of a gang violence, now they are the intended victim, if they happen to be the race that that gang is seeking to attack.
Brian Levin is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at Cal State University San Bernardino, another advisor to the commission.
Many groups share similar hatreds. So, for instance, gay bashing or anti-immigrant sentiment or attacks relating to Islamophobia, there's a democracy to it in the sense that it's not merely white on minority, but a whole set of groups on that particular target.
Levin also points out that most hate crimes are not committed by organized hate groups at all. However, the dissemination of their material on the internet has had an effect on the community most likely to commit a hate crime.
Most hate crimes are committed by informal association of young males who are either out for a thrill or protecting their turf or seeking peer validation.
National figures for hate crimes in 2007 have yet to be released. Brian Levin notes that New York's comparable figures, a 30% rise, may foreshadow the numbers to come.
That probably portends, I would guess, to some kind of increase nationally, at least from what we hear anecdotally.
Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center agrees and notes there is no way to know.
The national statistics are so fatally flawed that even when they are published for 2007, we still will not know if hate crimes are going up or down.
A 2005 victimization study by the Bureau of Justice Statistics showed that the level of national hate crimes, reported and unreported, was 191,000 incidents. And that's 19 to 31 times higher than what the FBI hate crime statistics showed for the period. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dan Fritz.
FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org. For the past week, a raging row over language has gripped public life in Nepal. The controversy started when its newly elected vice president took his oath of office in Hindi, its neighbor India's official language. Protests, which began last week, once again brought up the centuries of old tensions between the people of the hill regions and the southern plains of Nepal. FSRN's PC Dubey reports.
This oath of office by Nepal's new vice president in Hindi whipped up a political turmoil in Nepal. Youth groups of major political parties accused Vice President Paramanand Jha as anti-national and even an agent of India. They burned Vice President's effigies, clashed with police, and ransacked vehicles in all corners of the country. Ritu Raj, a Maoist youth activist, thinks the Vice President should have taken the oath in any of the domestic Nepali languages and not Hindi.
Nepali is our national language, but Nepal recognizes other indigenous languages like Maithili, Bhojpuri and Awadhi, which Madhesi people speak in southern Nepal, as the country's languages. There would have been no problem if Jha had taken oath in any of these indigenous languages.
According to Ritu Raj, Vice President's oath in Hindi threatens Nepal's national integrity.
Jha actually should be voted out of the office by the Constituent Assembly. This would send a clear message to India's puppets in the garb of Nepal citizens that the Nepalese people would never accept them.
The row over language and culture in Nepal is centuries old. Over 250 years, the majority hill people cherished their Nepali roots, often bordering hegemony against the people at the plains, who were settlers from India and spoke languages like Bhojpuri, Maithili, Awadhi and Hindi. Kamlesh Pathak, a political analyst from the plains, thinks the current row over the vice president's oath is the evidence for the dominance of the hill people over people like him.
The hill track people, or Bahadis, are not ready to accept the leadership of Madhesi's people from the plains. For the past 250 years, the Madhesi community has remained a political untouchable in the country. But the scenario has now changed. The Bahadi leadership has failed to stop it, but they are not prepared for the change and have resorted to protest and violence on an irrational issue as to why the vice president took the oath in Hindi.
The new vice president Jha is a former Supreme Court judge. He later joined the main political party from the plains, Madhes Janadhikar Forum, and last month won a four-corner fight to become the vice president of the country. Political analysts from plains like Pathak, who are supportive of the vice president's oath in Hindi, argue Maoist spearhead the agitation against Hindi language.
Actually, Hindi is the inalienable part of the culture of the people in the plains. Nepali language also enjoys status of the Indian language in hill regions like Darjeeling of India. The culture of the people of the regions is Nepali. They speak the Nepali language. So is it not preposterous to whip up such turmoil over Hindi, which is also a cultural geographical language of Nepal?
The plains politicians remain supportive of the vice president, Upendra Yadav, leader of Madhesi People's Forum.
Hindi is also our language. Hindi is dear to our Madhesi people as Nepali is dear to the Pahadi people.
But Abhay Kumar Jha, a Madhesi political activist of Vice President Jha's ethnic community, who speaks indigenous Maithili language, said that the vice president should have avoided controversy by taking oath either in Nepali or Maithili. But he also felt that the oath in Hindi was in no way an affront to the national honor.
The vice president has committed a minor error. Nepali would have been better, but it has not uprooted the Himalaya. After all, practically half the Nepalese population speaks Hindi.
Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Vice President Jha apologized in a statement ending the controversy, at least for now. But the rift over language is here to continue between the plains and the hills people. From the plains in Nepal, I am PC Dubey for FSRN.
We start a new series on FSRN today, featuring historic audio preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives. Once a week, we'll rewind some 40 years and hear from the voices that shaped a movement for change. We'll hear from anti-war protests, raising the black fist at the Olympics, the Chicago DNC, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy, and a lot more. We kick off this week by hearing a portion of a momentous interview between Congressman William F. Ryan and General David M. Shoup, a decorated Marine commander who served in Vietnam and returned to the U.S. to become one of the most vocal critics against the war.
This is Congressman William F. Ryan reporting from Washington. Our guest today is General David M. Shoup, retired, a combat veteran of World War II, winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, and former Commandant of the United States Marine Corps from 1960 to 1963. The discussion today will focus on the question of the war in Vietnam. I think it's terribly important that the American people hear from experienced military officers and understand that there is not a unanimity of view on the war which is currently taking progress in Southeast Asia. In 1966, in May, in Los Angeles, in a speech which you gave, you made headlines. Let me quote from General Shoup's speech at that time. He said, "I believe that if we had and would keep our dirty, bloody, dollar-crooked fingers out of the business of these nations so full of depressed and exploited people, they will arrive at a solution of their own, which they will design and want, that they fight and work for. And if, unfortunately, their revolution must be of the violent type, because the haves refuse to share with the have-nots by any peaceful method, at least what they get will be their own, and not the American style, which they don't want crammed down their throat by Americans." End of quote. General Shoup, that was nearly a year and a half ago, when we had not lost as many lives as we have today in Vietnam. Has your view changed any in the interim period?
Mr. Congressman, first I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. I feel quite honored to appear with you on this program. And as far as my attitude with respect to that remark is concerned, I would like to say that I am pretty sure that more people today believe in what I said than they did a year and a half ago. That the people there are not too happy about us encroaching upon their daily life, killing their women and children, devastating their country, and disrupting what for centuries has been their way of doing things.
There's one other point I'd like to raise with you, General, because I know that you are very concerned about it, and that's the question of the youth of America, the question of protests that have taken place on some of the campuses, the disenchantment which is taking place in many of our young people. Do you think this generation is any different, really, than other generations of Americans?
I think that we overlook the fact that we've told semi-truths and lies to our young people for so long that they're finally revolting and they want the truth. And they want it very much like their elders do in some areas. The elders today say, well, why don't they just once? And when they say they, I guess they mean those gents back in Washington. That's usually what they refer to. Why don't they just once try telling the truth first? These youngsters want the truth. We start out with Santa Claus and Columbus and on and on and on and on and on, and we pull the wool over their eyes and they're lied to in their history books. And since the Vietnam thing, they certainly don't forget the promise about letting the Asian boys fight it. They don't forget the promise about we're not going to escalate. They're wondering, what is this business of growing up in America? What are we going to inherit from our elders? Can we, are we expected to continue this hogwash, this bunch of lies to our youngsters and the next generation? That's what they're worried about.
That was General David M. Shoup speaking with Congressman William F. Ryan in audio preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives. More information on pacificaradioarchives.org. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.